Hey, welcome back to a brand new episode of The Film Show. Three new films up for discussion today. I will be talking about the mesmerizing return of Richard Stanley, in itself a great thing, with The Color Out of Space. I will be talking about Lee Whannell's new The Invisible Man, of course, a kind of co-adaptation, let's say, of the 30s and the Verhoeven version. And I will be talking about the new Pixar movie, which, depending on when you're listening to this, has either just opened or is just about to open, Onwards. Until then, until we get into that, I have a film recommendation. I don't really recommend films, but I do occasionally, and there's one recommendation at the moment, which I've already recommended to a friend of mine, who actually is the warden of an island not far from where I am, and she does that with her boyfriend, so they're just there on their own. At the moment, you can imagine being in a better place, like really being in an absolutely better place than where they are. And so I recommended to her that she watch Contagion, the Steven Soderbergh movie from, I can't remember when it was from, 2000-something, I think, 2008, maybe? I can't quite remember. But in that, it deals with a world outbreak of a new virus, and I'm not joking, like, she was shocked by how close it was to what's going on right now. Like, she couldn't get over it. Like, she was absolutely shocked on her ass, and that's the thing. Like, that movie now plays, like, you could watch Outbreak, you could watch The Andromeda Strain, there's plenty of other kind of, like, you know, hyped-up ones of this, which is just stupid, but that film, Contagion, is just so close to what's going on when you switch over to the news. It's frightening. Stop it. Can you hear that? Can you hear the dog shaking in the background? Pain in the ass. It is, yeah, it's just shocking. Like, you know, if it was a zombie outbreak, like, you know, then imagine if there was a zombie outbreak and you'd be watching a zombie movie in your house and you just turn over to the television and you're watching Dawn of the Dead, let's say, and then you just turn around and it's happening. It's like, now that's never going to happen, probably, but this is happening. So I would recommend, I've already rewatched it, I actually watched all the movies that I've mentioned as well, because they just tie in nicely. I mean, I understand it's like a weird thing to do, but it just ties, like, you know, like in the winter, you watch winter movies, you want to watch snow movies and things like that. Like, you know, it makes sense. Like, the movies tie into the current emotional state that's around, and, you know, Contagion is the perfect film for it. It's absolutely perfect, believe me. It will, like I said, it will feel almost as if it's predicted, or like just like a straight documentary in parts. Anyway, not all of it, but largely in parts, it will feel like that. Okay, right, so go watch Contagion. But until then, stick around for 20-odd minutes while we get into the movies. And first up will be the astounding return of Richard Stanley with The Color Out of Space. Okay, so it's The Color Out of Space, and the important thing to note straight away is that Richard Stanley is back, and that's a big, big thing. So if you don't know who Richard Stanley is, he was one of the hot young British directors in the, I think it's, what would we say, in the 80s. He was at college and then came through with music videos in the late 80s, and then, of course, in the 90s, the early 90s, he got to make his first feature. And so off the back of shorts he'd made at college, and it was very exciting because Hardware, which is like a post-apocalyptic movie set in London, so it's like in, like, a, you know, a desolate, destroyed London, kind of very proto-punk movie, was an instant hit in that it didn't make like shit tons of money or anything, but it came right at the end of that kind of Palace Pictures revolution that was going on in Britain at the time. And then on the back of that, he got to make Dust Devil, which is one of the true cult movies of that decade. In a decade when there isn't that much cult greatness, but that is one of the true cult movies. So then off the back of that, which wasn't a big success, but his reputation was growing and growing and growing. And so he was offered a Hollywood job to make the new Island of Dr. Moreau. And it did not go well. That is an understatement. If you, without spoiling it, there is a documentary from 2014 called Lost Soul, The Doomed Journey of Richard Stanley's Island of Dr. Moreau. And it really is. It's one of those stories. It is a true horror story. Probably more horrifying. It's worse than the Lost in La Mancha thing, where, you know, it's Gilliam trying to make Don Quixote for like the third or fourth time, which he finally has done, and, you know, all the problems that beset the production. And this is the same, but it's worse. It is actually worse. It's a horrible documentary to watch. Your heart bleeds for him. And anyway, after, so that was 96. Since then, he has not directed a movie of any kind until now. So that is 23 years? Yeah, 23, 24 years until he's been back in the chair. And this is The Color Out of Space. So this is the guy, these are the guys who produced, Elijah Wood is one of them, who, and Elijah Wood, I assume has something to do with this because he's a massive horror fan. Has his own horror festival in Los Angeles. You know, is clearly has taken the money from the Hobbit movies and has decided, or Lord of the Rings, decided to do with his career what he wants to, and horror is a big part of it. So I imagine that he has more than a strong understanding of who Stanley is and where he stands in that canon. And so giving him this job is a big, big thing. So it is based on a Lovecraft story from 1927, where it is set on the farm where a character has decided to, like, he's decided to, in a way, step away from life, withdraw, take his family with him, and he's trying to be an alpaca farmer and also grow tomatoes. Like, you know, I'm not doing well at either. His wife is recovering or currently with cancer, and his, you know, son and daughter are struggling with this life of being isolated. You know, their relationship is struggling, and because of the idea for the farm, she runs, I think she does insurance or something like that, or financial stuff, and so she's like in the middle of nowhere. Her internet connection is terrible, so her business is like very stressful now. And so a guy turns up who is surveying the water table in the area because of a hydroelectric dam, and what happens is a meteor hits just outside the farm one night. It becomes news, but the meteor has, in a way, kind of like infected the land, the ground, the water, the plants, and Nick Cage's character, the father character, Nathan. And so then we journey into that madness in a way as it goes on. It is a bright, colourful, vibrant, exciting movie. It's a true cult movie. This is the thing about Stanley, and that has not left this production. This is a film where I can't say that I loved it. I was excited that he was back. It's got some beautiful visuals in it. Some of the acting's a little ropey, and of course you've got Cage doing his usual, because the guys who produced this, some of them also produced Mandy, and so I assume they like Cage as an actor. Personally, I find it too much. This will always divide people, I know, with, you know, the Cage rage and all that. And in this, he's just, you know, as he becomes more kind of like infected and gets taken over, I suppose, you know, he's doing more Nick Cage and more Nick Cage, and it's just every time he does it, it kind of takes away from the scene. It doesn't add to the scene. That's the problem. It doesn't add anything. It just kind of subtracts everything else. But remove, for me anyway, just simply remove that, and what you have left beyond that, especially in terms of the story, the storytelling, and the background and the visuals, is fantastic. It's like genuinely, genuinely cult stuff, and that's what I was reminding myself as I watched it. Like, I like to watch movies and think, like, if the Moviedrome TV show existed, you know, now, what would end up on it from, like, you know, 10 years ago, 20 years ago? Because obviously when I saw that Landmark show on the BBC, it was all stuff from the 80s, the 70s, and backwards from there, because that's when it was on TV. Now I think, like, you know, what would qualify as a future Moviedrome picture, or, you know, from, if I think back to, like, the noughties or just before, like, what from there might end up on Moviedrome? And this, I think, is undoubtedly because of Stanley, because the fact that you could double it with Dust Devil or Hardware or have a treble even, you know, this is a Moviedrome picture. It's a true cult movie. It really, really is. Apparently he's been signed up for two more, and given that Elijah Wood is involved in it, I can actually believe this is true. Two more Lovecraft adaptations, with the Dunwich Horror being the one of them. This seems to have gone over rather well, which is extremely exciting. This is not dissimilar to another movie that I've seen, which I'm not going to talk about yet, but it's by another director called Oz Perkins, and that's come out in the States already, and I've seen it. I've got no idea when it's coming out here, so it might be on a show soon, hopefully. But that has made damn good money as well. And so this just means any form of success, if it's critical success, you know, just a good word of mouth, this is how these people get to work again. This is how they get to work in the future, and that's unbelievably exciting. I mean, I'm pretty sure I can say this, if you end up seeing it, I have no idea where I think it's already on Amazon Prime, because it's one of those movies partly funded by, you know, by a big service. And I'm assuming it's in cinemas somewhere around the UK at the moment, although I'm not sure where. It's nowhere near me, obviously. But if you can go and see it on a big screen, I can imagine it looks even better, to be quite honest, than it would in the telly. I will say that, because of the visuals part of it, like when it all happens and the colours, because the whole point of the book, in the Lovecraft book, is the colours are unreal. You can't really describe them. They're a kind of purple, or they're a kind of blue, but they're not any on the actual scale for you to give them a name. So they're not magenta, they're not cyan, and so forth. And that's the whole point. Everything, like, you know, when the tomatoes grow all huge, you know, he's so excited and tastes them, and it tastes wrong. Everything is wrong. Nothing is right. That's the point. Nothing is real. Oh, and on top of that, you've also got Tommy Chong playing kind of like a insane hippie. Nothing surprising there. Who is who's at one with the land and so forth, and that alone is, you know, has a majesty to it. I don't know what to say other than, yeah, this is just for anybody who loves cult stuff, anybody who wants a notion of what will be cult tomorrow, this is the perfect film for you. And if you don't know who Richard Stanley is, then go watch Lost Soul, and go watch Hardware, and go watch Dust Devil, because those really are worth your time. And this is just another, you know, weird entry. Now, what is it, from Hardware, you're talking about 30 years on from Hardware. This is only the third film he's completed, because he didn't get anywhere near completing the Dr. Moreau picture. We'll have to watch the documentary to find out exactly what he did, which in itself is largely batshit. But it's just phenomenal that he's back. It really is phenomenal that he's back. And, you know, true to his colours, he's delivered something unique, and he's delivered something that will, I think, be rediscovered in time. And people will, you know, take notice of it. I really do think, I mean, I would say that, even though I didn't love Mandy, I would say that it's a movie drone picture. There's no two ways about that. People will find that movie in 10 years' time, and it will, for some people, it will wow them. For other people, it might leave them a bit cold, but they will appreciate the uniqueness of it. I will admit that, without doubt, in that, yes, it's a, you know, kind of like conglomeration of so many other horror tropes and stuff, but it doesn't matter. Like, it's got its own style. It's absolutely got its own style, Mandy has, and so does The Color Out of Space. So if you can see it, if you've got Amazon Prime, I think it's on Amazon Prime, if you've got it, whack it on, give it a go. Even if you don't do the whole thing, I'm sure you'll feel and see something in it that's quite unique. Okay, right, so there you go, Color Out of Space. It's either in a cinema somewhere near you, or it is on a VOD service. And take a quick break, and I'll be back to talk about the new Pixar movie in a second. Okay, right, so onward. The first, I think it's one of two, at least two Pixar movies that is coming out this year, and it's not out for like a week, I think. It's out next weekend. But I saw it earlier, not through any magic or because I'm so awesome. They just had it on a week earlier for some reason, just for the one day. I have no idea why. So this is a teen drama, set in a fantastical world where there was once, like, basically it's set in, think of like Lord of the Rings world, that being the real past. Okay, think about it like that. That's the easiest way to describe it. So there was magic and so forth, but there's no humans. It's all like elves and orcs and so forth, and, you know, like, and there were wizards, but even the wizards were creatures. Then over time, what's happened is there's been, like, somebody invented the light bulb, you see that, you know, and then of course there's been more technology, like, you know, like humanity, there's just a thirst for technology, for progress. And so in this kind of, in the Industrial Revolution within this world, to cars, roads, people have forgotten about, so, you know, forgotten about everything, forgotten about magic, but everything. So there's like a character in it who is called Colt Bronco, who is a centaur, but he's also a policeman, and he's dating the mother in it, and he doesn't even run anymore. Like, centaurs used to run, you know, across the plains and the world and so forth. His answer is simple: I don't need to, I got a car. If you see what I'm saying, so can you understand where I'm going with that now? So there's two brothers, there's Ian and Bali. Ian's the young one, and basically Ian never met his dad. He died, his dad died while he was yet to be born. And so Bali has, you know, like, he's only a few years older. Bali, has, I assume, is like 17, you know, 18, and then Ian is around 13, 14. I can't quite remember. Yeah, they do. It's his birthday coming up. So he's becoming a teen. Yeah, so I think the age disparity is like that. So Bali has some memories of him. He has like three or four separate memories of him, but there's this great emptiness, obviously, in Ian's life because of this. So on his birthday, his mum gives him a gift that his father left for him. And it's a magical staff with a with a magical stone, and there's a spell to bring the father back alive for 24 hours, and so they can spend some time together, sort of thing. And of course, he casts the spell, but only half of his it doesn't fully work. Only half of it come of his brother, of his father, comes up to his belly. And so his brother convinces him, because his brother's massively into history, the past, and he plays like a Dungeons and Dragons style board game, which is all based on historical fact in that world. This is where it's different to humanity in a way. So if you had all this with people, obviously that board game would not be based on historical fact. It would be based on, you know, mythical entities sort of thing, not on history. And so his brother convinces him that they can find another stone to do the spell again if they go on this quest, just like in the game. Off they go on the quest, and then of course it becomes a learning experience for both of them, far greater and wider than the initial quest of getting the stone and completing the spell. This is very similar to Inside Out, I think, that these two Pixar movies kind of like stand alone a little bit, and I'll get to that in a second. But what it is that they're both inspired by true stories. So for the writers, for the people who developed this, it is inspired by the relationship he had with his brother, having lost his father. Whereas Inside Out, it was directly taken from the experience of moving house when young, and how moving town, moving state, and how that was, how complicated emotionally that was. So if you think of, like, you know, different layers of Pixar, you have like the classic Pixar, the Pixar like movies like Toy Story, Monsters Inc., and they tend to be the early movies up, which redefined animation, really, and also created almost this new kind of, I suppose, this new kind of off the back of The Simpsons, because there's a Simpsons short before this, and it's almost like The Simpsons did start that, where they created this whole new kind of animation where parents could go watch it with their children, and both sets of, you know, audience members would get something radically different out of it. Like, obviously, parents, you think of Monsters, Inc. as the perfect example of this. Parents who go and watch that with kids who are scared of, you know, maybe the monster in the closet and all that, are going to get so much more, and the positivity aspect of laughter being, you know, more energetic than screams. You know, they're going to take so much more out of that kind of notion of being told what it is, and kind of accepting when you're young, like, this is bad, this is good, but maybe it isn't quite like that. Maybe there's a reason why you're being told this. Whereas kids are obviously just going to see the monsters, they're going to see Sully, they're going to see Boo, they're going to have this whole magical world opened up to them. And it's you know, radically different what both ends of the audience are taking from that film. Then you can move into, you know, there's like a different bracket of Pixar movies, like Cars is the great example, which is essentially just for kids. There's nothing in that movie, I don't think, for adults. It's like almost like that's the classic end of Pixar animation, in that it's made strictly for kids, and without being cynical, the spin-off into all the cars and shit you can sell from it. But now it's almost like Pixar are starting up a whole new, like, little subgenre for themselves. And I think these two movies are very similar in that these, I think, are directed almost entirely at teenagers. The principal characters are teenagers. They're, and as an older person, there was things in it that felt really beautiful to me. Like, you know, they're almost tear-inducing. These are the lessons learned and so forth, and how, you know, about gratitude, and how you can realize that even though you're having these experiences and you think you're not having the right experience, you're not having the experience you want exactly, but everything else is happening around you pretty much exactly as if you wanted it to. It's just not how you imagined it. But if you pause and step back and look at it, you could be so much more thankful for that in the moment than probably that I am anyway. And so there's so much of that in it. But I think that this is almost like a whole new thing for Pixar, in that there are movies now being made strictly, I think, for recent teenagers. So let's say from the age of 11 up until maybe early 20s, you know, where they're still fresh to that idea of being a teenager. And this is undoubtedly one of them. It is like a true journey in that respect. I don't think that I would class it above, you know, the true classics of Pixar, like I said, like Toy Story, like Up, like Monsters, Inc., films that have, like, that are so well-known, films that all the people, you know, like, you know, look at the amount of tattoos that are done from these films, look at how everybody knows the characters, everybody knows the lines from these, you know, very transformational films, at the genesis of that studio, where they were seemingly just chugging out one classic after another. But this is, I thought this was very good. Of all recent Pixar, which I haven't been overly into most of them, except for Inside Out, which I thought was, because it was so fresh, it was so new, it was very different. The way they they put the experience through a teenager. It felt very real in a way, and even now as an adult, you can understand, like, you know, the different emotions that go on in your head and how you really should be careful which one you allow to take charge at any given moment, in a way, if you want to put it like that. But it felt like so well worked out, and the notion in Inside Out, of course, of like that bad experiences are critical. They're essential. You can't go through your life just having happy experiences. You will have unhappy experiences. It's how you operate them within your mind in terms of the learning experience that is important. And there's so much of that in this. I don't think it's as good as Inside Out, but I actually thoroughly enjoyed it. I wouldn't run back to see it tomorrow, to be quite honest. I don't think it's as revolutionary, but is anything going to be as revolutionary as those early films? Probably not, in terms of the universes they created. I mean, it's asking a lot, I think, for something to come along to have the same cultural impact as Toy Story, for instance. I just don't think that's possible, probably. But I thoroughly enjoyed it as a kind of like, a second tier Pixar movie. I thought it was excellent. And it's small. It's a very small film. It's got like Tom Holland, Chris Pratt, Octavia Spencer, and Julie Louis-Dreyfus, and that's it. And then it's like very much a supporting cast beyond that, like, you know, with Tracy Ullman and Ali Wong and so forth. But they're very small characters. It's a very small film, very kind of driven in on, basically the two brothers and then just side characters around them. And that's pretty much it. But even the mother and she befriends this kind of manticore who was kind of like, the manticore has, because of the time of magic has passed, she has become like a restaurant owner, but then it's like dumbed everything down, and she kind of finds herself in throughout this as well, in terms of like, you know, the I don't know, what would you call it, like, you know, the kind of like graceful kind of beast that she was, and she kind of refines that in the middle of all this journey. So yeah, there's some nice stuff in it. There's some really, really nice stuff in it. I don't think it's the best Pixar movie of all time by any stretch, but I think of, like, if you think of it in two or three different layers, for me, this comfortably sits in that second layer, quite underneath, you know, the classic of classics, the holy of holies of that studio. But this sits, you know, like, it's better, for instance, than, for me, it's better than Coco, it's better than Brave, things like that, like, easily better than them for me. You might disagree, but it's definitely, I mean, Disney heads are going to go and see it no matter what, but it's definitely worth your time, in my opinion. It's got some lovely stuff in it. Okay, right. So that's Onward. It will be out in the cinema, depending on when you're listening to this. It should be out in the cinema now, actually. It's only out from when I'm recording this. It's only 4 or 5 days. So I'll be back in a second to talk about, The Invisible Man. Oh, yes. Okay, so around the mid-2000s, Universal came up with the idea of kind of rebooting all their classic monster series. So that is the Dark Universe, as it's called. So that is The Mummy, Dracula, Frankenstein, Invisible Man, Black Lagoon, and so forth and so forth. So out of this, thus far, as we stand right now, you had the Dracula prequel, which was, you know, fun, but a throwaway. I mean, it was really a throwaway. It was, and I don't think you got the sense that they didn't actually believe in it that deeply. But it was an okay film. A bit too much of a CGI fest, but it was okay. Then you had The Mummy, or as it became known, The Mummy Impossible, because, they cast Tom Cruise in it, and it is just, I think what it is they're caught between two stools with it. So you want to kind of recreate this classic horror from the 30s, but Universal can't get past the fact that with those, the Stephen Sommers, was it? The relaunched movies in whatever the hell that was, the 90s? Maybe the beginning of the noughties, maybe the ones with Brendan Fraser. I mean, they were huge financial successes, as terrible as they were. I'm not a fan of those films. Jess, far more of a fan. She kind of sees them for the fun that they are. I did not like those movies, and I think they were caught between two stools in understanding, kind of realizing, like, we wanted some of the horror, but we want to put the action in as well, because look, it worked then, and they ended up nowhere with it, and it just feels like a Mission Impossible movie, but with this ancient horror figure in it for no apparent reason whatsoever. So after that, the idea of having a shared universe and so forth went, as well, by the by. They've ditched that, and they've come up with this idea now that they will have standalone stories. So I don't know if they're going back to Dracula or they're going back to The Mummy anytime soon, but again, here with The Invisible Man, they've understood that, finally got on top of it, because there was an idea of doing this with Johnny Depp. Jesus Christ, I can't imagine how terrible that would have been. But now they understand, kind of giving it to Lee Wan, all that. You know, this is essentially a horror story. Horror. That's the key element of this, is the horror, not anything else. So give it to someone who understands horror. This is a guy, of course, who has written multiple entries in the Saw category, Saw franchise, in the Insidious franchise. He's been around horror for years. He made Upgrade, I think, a year ago. Was it a year ago Upgrade came out? It was a great little horror sci-fi movie. Now he's been given something far bigger, obviously, in terms of budget and just in terms of expectation as well, and legacy. But the budget, you know, again, because of the way it's done, the budget is very small for an obvious reason. So, very simply, let's run through this, because what I love about this film, and I will admit that I was pumped up going in to see it, so I've maybe been, you know, maybe I'm being really nice about it, I don't know, but I've thoroughly enjoyed it. So you have Elizabeth Moss playing a character called Cecilia Cass, who is basically stuck in a controlling relationship with a scientist called Adrian Griffith, who we don't really see a great deal of. And she's, you know, she's in such a bad place that the film opens with her essentially not just like walking out, but having to escape the compound he's got her in. Like, he's a rich, rich guy. So he has this massive house on the side of the water. And I think it's just out of San Francisco. Massive walls surrounding it. You know, cameras everywhere, sensors, like an absolute compound. I'm going to have to be very careful what I say here. So I don't want to give anything away. But basically drugs him, gets out of there. And then it turns into this, she's, you know, then moves back in, I think moves into her own place, I think, but with her friend, who's a cop, moves in with her sisters around as well. And then she just starts to become convinced that someone's, like, watching her, little weird things are happening, you know, like, then, but then we find out that he's killed himself. His brother tells them, he's a lawyer, he's dealing with the estate, he's left her some money. But like I said, like, slowly but surely, as the days pass, she becomes completely convinced that something is wrong. And, of course, she can't point to anything because, A, he's dead, and, B, you can't see anything. But, you know, you can see what... So, essentially, it's sleeping with the enemy, but with a sci-fi horror element in it. And I can tell you right now, because the fact that I think he's kind of melded together the best elements of Hollow Man, of a Howard movie I still love, and the original... Invisible Man, it's just great. Like, it's just absolutely great. It's very deliberately paced early on, let me tell you that. It does ramp up. Like, it seriously ramps up. So if you're sitting there for the first hour and in your mind you're like, Jesus Christ, this is taking... Just understand that it's all deliberate. But the thing about this film is... one of the things I love about it is that he takes out of it the So in the other two versions of this, basically you have this scientist who is like completely committed, totally driven, but at the same time, you know, he's not a bad guy. The process brings out the worst instincts in him. Whereas in this, what I love is, no, he's just a bad guy. The ability to make himself invisible just makes him worse, but he's already a horrifyingly disgusting human being, and I like that about it. Like, I really like that about it, because you can just hate him from the word go, and that really works. But the elements that make this work beyond anything else is the subtlety. So it's three elements in a way that is critical to the success of this film. One is the camera work, because the camera work has to constantly point to the fact that someone's, you know, a voyeuristic camera, Hitchcock-esque, if you like, that's keeping an eye on her. So it constantly moves around corners, it comes back into the room, it's quite withdrawn at times. So you have this sense that we're looking through the eyes of Adrian, or the Invisible Man, if you like. And that really is done well. Like, it pans even up to the roof at times and so forth. There's this notion of being observed that's really well done through the camera angles and the camera choices in it. That is the cinematography by Stefan Dusio. And, I mean, it's really well done. Second is the score by Benjamin Wellfish, which is... It's just the rise and fall of it. Like, he understands that you have to have it calm, 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 but... The whole thing is about tension. The whole thing is about unease. So you have to almost, like, again, Hitchcock-esque, like Psycho and so forth, you know, with the screeching strings by Bernard Herrmann, it has to really go from, like, low to really fucking ramped up, like, as quickly as possible to create that notion of, just imagine if you actually fucking believed there was an invisible person after you. How unbelievably mentally overwhelming that would be. Like, if you believed it, like, because of the work he did, because he worked in optics and he was this genius, you know, she can imagine that he's in some way concocted something that could make this happen. And she's already terrified of him and terrified of the fact that he will go to any lengths. That's the point. He's an angry dude, he's a possessive dude, but he's a dude that will go to any lengths. That's the thing. He won't stop. There's this, you know, sometimes with people, you know that as kind of like, you know, they talk a big game, but you know that they're not going to put those big boy pants on, if you like, to do something really nasty. You kind of know that you're on safe ground a little bit. Like, it's a lot of it's chatter, you know, a lot of it's talk. But this is the thing about him, is it's not that. This is action. This isn't tittle tattle. So in a way, you have, like I said, you have a modern version of Sleeping with the Enemy, but with an invisible man built in, or gaslight, if you like. The whole notion, she even says it in the big line in it, is that she even says it in the moment, like, she's lived a life where she is being convinced that she was always wrong, that she was to blame, that everything she did was not good enough. You know, that, and that's psychological fucking warfare that she's been through. And of course, the third element, the most important element, not surprisingly, is the person you cast as the star, because the film is so driven through her performance. Like, it's almost like, if you think, like, Onward had a small cast, like I was saying, this is like minuscule. You have her, the sister, who has like a couple of scenes, her friend, the cop, again, who's a little bit more prevalent with his daughter, the brother, and of course, Adrian, the Invisible Man himself. That's it. Like, this is a minimal cast, especially for 2 hours. Like, super goddamn minimal. And Elizabeth Moss, obviously, as one of the finest actresses in the world currently, she is just phenomenal in it. Like, so committed, absolutely all in performance. And I would imagine that even Lee Whannell, the director, would admit, like, you know, she does half the work of the movie for you. Like, it's such a fucking phenomenal performance. There are a few moments in it where you think, why did that happen? Why would you do that? But you have to, like, you know, this is a difficult thing in terms of the, because it is like a pursuit horror, there are going to be a few moments where you're like, and the conclusion, there's definitely two or three things in it that I did not see coming, that I genuinely like, whoa. But the conclusion you can see coming because of one thing that happens. You can absolutely see it coming, but it's still great. It's still gnarly. It's still like savage, you know? And there's also a scene at the end which doesn't make a lot of sense, but you kind of want her kind of walking away all powerful and so forth. So there are these couple of moments in it where you question, does that really work? Like, how would that work? And, you know, is there a hole there in the plot? But they are small and they're understandable, because this is a horror movie with an invisible man in it. You know, like, if that isn't a plot hole to a certain extent, you know, what isn't? It's just great. It's just absolutely fucking great. First big movie of the year for me, I think. I'm trying to look back now. Assuming, again, that you're bumping all those, you know, the Uncut Gems and things like that. Even though I saw them in 2020, they're all 2019 movies. They just come out late here. But this is the first 2020 movie. Like, when you go to IMDb, it'll be 2020, it won't be 2019. First truly big movie of the year for me, and it's a horror movie, which is incredibly exciting. I just was a little bit less overwhelmed than I was. She's like a notch down from me. But for me, and I admit, I put my hand up again and say, like, you know, maybe I was like, just like, you know, outrageously carried away because I was so wanting it to be good. But for me, it really fucking worked. Like, it really does work. The scenario's perfect. The setup's perfect. The design of the invisible thing, how it works, I think is excellent. I really like what they've done with it. It's reminiscent of another recent movie where this kind of idea, kind of like, you know, could be real right now. I don't know. I don't want to spoil anything about it. That's the thing. I don't want to spoil anything about it, because it does have a couple of really good, like, whoa, the fuck moments. Invisible Man, just go see it. That's it. If you like horror, like I said, be aware it's paced in the first half. It's quite steady, but that is because it continually ramps up like a motherfucker as it gets towards the end. I don't know what to say. It's just great. I loved it. It goes straight into my horror rotation in October, not a doubt at all. Okay, right, The Invisible Man, it's out in the cinema now. Do yourself a favour, just go see the first truly excellent movie of 2020. Okay, right, quick break, and I'll be back to wrap it all up and talk about what's... I've got actually no idea what's coming up next, so let's talk about whatever. thank you very much to anybody who listens to this podcast, shares this podcast, tells anyone about this podcast, comes to my website, lmcullen.com, whatever it is. My new thing on Instagram is about to start in the next week or so, finally getting back on there with a new concept. I can't talk about it yet, but I will be able to talk about it over the next coming weeks. Actually, it is very interactive, hopefully. And I think it's a good idea, I really do, because it's not a comfortable place for me at all, so it'll be interesting, and the journey itself will be interesting. Okay, right, that sounds so wanky what I just said, but it's just a film journey, it's nothing like where I have to get up and do anything. I'll be back in a week. I don't think I actually will be back in a week, it'll be just over a week, I think, because there's absolutely nothing opening this weekend. For the first time in, I think, almost 70-odd shows, like, there is, I mean, Military Wives is opening, there's no way I'm going to go see that movie. You'd have to pay me an astounding amount of money to go watch that movie, like, literally a lot of money. The same as that horse, Welsh horse film coming up. Jesus Christ, that looks terrible. Like, there's this thing, it's just a sad indictment of British film now. Like, this is it. Like, it's just, these are the same films you get. These, like, every year, there'll be two of them. Every year, at this time of year, every time, just like a conveyor belt. You know, just these people, either kind of like, you know, gang of misfits coming together, unlikely story of, so it's just the same thing over and over and over again. It's so depressing, like, it's so utterly, it relates to nothing about reality in Britain currently at all, nothing. And I understand that films can be fantasy, but these are our equivalency of Marvel movies. Like, that's how sad it is here. Like, they're just extended, you know, fantasy movies, pretty much the same formula every time. This is the same, but all it is just people, like, putting a choir together. It's so fucking depressing. Okay, right, I'll be back. I know Fantasy Island is opening, which looks terrible. I mean, if you ever want to understand, like, how different things can be from one movie to the next, go watch The Invisible Man, then go watch Fantasy Island. I understand they're both under the Blumhouse banner, but my God, the difference in quality I predict between those two will be astounding. And The Hunt's opening, I think, in the middle of the week after. Who knows? Who knows? I mean, Quiet Place is now only like a week and a half away, thankfully. Yeah, we'll see what comes up. We'll see what crops up. Maybe something come up on Netflix or something. But I'll be back. I'll be back at some point. Don't worry. You know, no matter what. I mean, I might be the only thing going at one point, and if this carries on, you know, like, this coronavirus carries on, there might be just me here talking about movies. That's it. That's all you'll have, if any, until the internet conks out, obviously. But until then, please make sure you look after yourselves, please, and make sure you look after everybody else that's important to you, and tell people what you feel about them, like, really do. It can be so rewarding and so freeing for you as well as them. Okay, right, until then, do as much creative stuff, watch as much creative stuff as possible. It really is one of the most beautiful things in the world, if not the most beautiful thing outside of human contact. And until then, until we're all together again, please, 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 have a great week.